The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Louise Dovray Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is April 26, 2022. This is the first of three cases that are scheduled for oral argument this morning. This is the matter of Elizabeth Frandup versus Leo Frandup. I know you're both familiar with our procedures, and I will just remind you that you each have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal should you choose to use it. No recording of this proceeding is permitted under our rules. Other than that, we are proceeding as if we were in the real courtroom. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is John Burns, and I represent the appellant, Leo Frandup. This is an appeal from an order for protection, a five-month order for protection, issued after a hearing on September 13, 2021. The court should be aware that that order for protection has expired. As I indicated, it was a five-month order for protection, and it was not extended or requested to be extended. The parties are also litigating separately a divorce action that is still pending. They've been married for 30 years now. Mr. Frandrup is 71 years old. Ms. Frandrup is 49. During the time that the parties were married and together, law enforcement was never involved. Ms. Frandrup never left the home and sought protection. And before the filing of the petition, there had never been any allegations of abuse. The parties do own a home in Lakeville, and the result of the order was to remove Mr. Frandrup from the home, a home that he owned for 10 years prior to the parties getting married, and that he had built and completed the construction of the homestead on the property. In her petition for an order for protection, Ms. Frandrup relied on three alleged incidents. One in 2011, one in 2012, and one in the year 2020. She claimed that she sought medical assistance on two occasions. One with the 2012 incident, she says that 2 weeks afterwards, she went in for medical assistance, but admits that she didn't tell anyone that her injury was the result of domestic abuse.
And the same. Mr. Burns, I just want to stop you. I mean, I am familiar with the facts. I understand that the parties disputed the relevant facts. But I also understand from your briefing that you're not so much challenging the district court's findings, acknowledging that there was evidence presented that would support a finding that domestic abuses occurred. But I think the gist of your argument, if I'm understanding it correctly, is notwithstanding the elements, if you will, of domestic abuse in support of an OFP are met, but that there was an abuse of discretion by the district court in deciding that under all of these circumstances, an OFP should be issued at all. Am I getting that right?
You're exactly correct, Your Honor. Thank you. And I'll move to that part. We even say so in our brief. My original brief, page 6, acknowledges that the incidents are sufficient to support a finding that domestic abuse occurred. But it's what the court didn't do after that. When we're looking at cases like this, we're trying to see that we have findings sufficient so that a meaningful review can occur on appeal. And that didn't.
Well, let me stop you there. I mean, this is the kind of findings in this case are typical of findings made when parties request OFPs. Or harassment restraining orders for that matter. I mean, they are sort of based on a form but it does contain findings. So what law would support that more findings are necessary for us to review and make a decision whether to affirm or reverse?
Respectfully, the Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 52.01, requires there to be findings of an amount and a sufficiency to allow for a meaningful review. And so as I look at the actual order for protection, and I agree that there are forms that are given to the judge to fill in, But the court does make sufficient findings on the allegations of abuse. It's the second part of it, the imminent danger so as to justify an order for protection, that there are no findings. And so there's room beginning on the bottom of the first page of the order for the order for protection. Like I said, the court makes several sentences talking about the incidents and the court's findings, but then does not make any analysis of whether there is an imminent threat. And what's critical here
is, what about the finding that that the petitioner is fearful of that your client would commit future acts of domestic abuse?
And that is exactly the finding that I'm talking about, Your Honor, is the support of that and what rationale the court is relying upon. Because the factual dialogue that I was providing at the beginning, what I was going to emphasize is that there were 13 months where the parties were together without incident, and that petitioner even says there was no problem between us for this 13 months. She admits that she's the one that initiated the issue with the parties in 2020, that she went and knocked on his door after midnight.
Isn't that just a credibility finding, though, of the district court? And we have to defer to credibility findings. Help us out here and explain why that's not the case.
I will. And I admitted in our brief, I think respondents counsel will talk about, you know, the deference due to a court for credibility. And I'm agreeing with her insofar as that the court found a petitioner credible on her claims, or at least did not find my client's version to be credible. But that is only as it relates to the underlying allegations of abuse. No findings of credibility were ever made on why there's an imminent fear, why there is a need to remove him from the home, why there's a bringing it forward from the incident. Why does an order for protection need to enter 13 months after the last allegation, with two other very remote allegations, with the request being to remove him from the home?
It seems to me, though, Mr. Burns, that the Thompson court, the Supreme Court in the Thompson case, rejected the argument you're advancing to us today, that in fact, I'm reading from the opinion, it would be inappropriate for us to read a temporal requirement or the word imminent into the statutory definition when no such requirement appears in the text. How is the argument you're making any different than the argument that was advanced in Thompson?
Thompson, which we rely upon in my brief, and I'm glad that the court is making reference to that. We think that is the authority for the court to review, requires that after making a finding of domestic abuse, that the court must then examine, and here's the term, all relevant circumstances, and determine whether it's exercise of discretion under the order for protection statute and determine what relief is appropriate. It is our position, and I brief it, that all relevant circumstances were not considered. The remoteness of the allegations, the period of time between the last allegation and the present, the pending divorce, the other issues that were involved, none of that was considered and needs to be. And because of the nature of the order for protection, which is...
No, how do we know the district court didn't consider it? I read the transcript and clearly you advanced these arguments. You made many challenges to the respondent's motivation and that she in fact initiated the dispute that led to the domestic abuse. So how do we conclude that the court didn't consider it?
Well, and that's my point exactly, Your Honor, is that we don't know. And the rules of civil procedure, as I indicated previously, make that a reversible error by the court. Mr. Frandrup is deprived of having that evidence so that there can be a meaningful review of what the court was thinking. I don't know how the court connected the incident to the current need. I don't know why 5 months was identified as an appropriate period of time. I don't know why removing him from the house was the remedy. There's a lot of unknowns. And while I do agree that a lot of order for protection practice is done by form, the court has to do better. And the judge has to do better and has to make more sufficient findings.
Counsel, I'd just like to pause for a second. You seem to rely quite a bit on Rule 52 and our review of a bench trial. And of course, as we've kind of alluded to, so these are somewhat summary proceedings, but of course you're still entitled to findings of fact, and they were made by the judge in this case. You seem to be arguing that the judge has to explicitly discuss all of the evidence and state why certain arguments that you made on behalf of Mr. Frandrup were rejected. And I'm unaware of any case law that would suggest that that's true. So you need to help me out if that's the way you read Rule 52, because I just don't see that.
I don't read it that way. I don't read it to have to deal with.
So then help me out. What, you know, when you say it's not clear that the district court judge considered all relevant circumstances, but you acknowledge that you presented those circumstances during the hearing and made the arguments, you know, our normal approach to that would be to assume that the district court judge considered all of the evidence. And really, you're making a weight and a credibility argument. You're asking us to second guess how the district court weighed the evidence and made credibility assessment. And as you know, that's something that an appellate court just doesn't do.
Right. And to be clear, I'm not asking that the credibility determinations on the abuse allegations be revisited. I'm saying that under the domestic abuse statute, there has to be a connection between the abuse allegations and the imminent danger. There has to be some present fear for safety. There has to be some reason why the order is constructed in the way that it is. And while it can be done summarily, you know, findings could have been made based upon part of her testimony or based upon evidence received, then the court finds that petitioner's fear for the present safety is reasonable. Simply adding a couple more sentences would have addressed that if that was the court's conclusion. But what we got instead was we had the hearing, a couple of days later we got the order, and there's no explanation of how the court finds that 13 months of no issues, that entire history that I was laying out before, how does that connect to an imminent threat? And how does that connect to a removal of Mr. Frandrup?
And I hate to sound like a broken record, but I think Judge Bjorkman has already pointed you to the language in Thompson, which suggests there is no temporal connection. And you're making an argument that's already been rejected by the Supreme Court. So I don't see why it would hold any persuasion with this court.
And respectfully, my response is that Thompson goes further than that. That Thompson does require, as I was quoting to the court previously, that there has to be a fashioning of the relief to be appropriate to the situation, and that doesn't occur here. What we have is this, very abbreviated 5-month order for protection, almost like a mini divorce trial issue that is decided. And it's being used in a context that it was never intended for. The court has the right to make credibility determinations, but the court also has an obligation to connect any finding of reasonable fear for safety to a present concern, and that was never made. It's for those reasons that we have asked that this court reverse the decision of the district court. No remand is requested. As indicated, the proceedings in that case have now expired, but we do believe that a reversal remains appropriate and reasonable, and that that remains our request. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Terrace, counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Well, thank you. I can be very brief. The court here actually brought up themselves several of the points I was going to make. I just would like to point out for the record that there are a lot of reasons why victims of domestic abuse report when they do, seek relief when they do. And the judge in this case clearly found her credible. We had a about a half day long trial. There was a lot of testimony. And as the court has already raised, these arguments were already made and they were rejected by the district court. As far as creating the nexus for Mr. Burns's client, why the record supports that there was a legitimate present fear, my client, as I stated in my brief, stated clearly that all of these very violent events, I mean, tremendous trauma. My client had trouble urinating for 2 weeks after one of them. These all involved cameras that were being placed around the property. And she stated on the record, and the judge found her credible, that the amount of cameras, the monitoring of her, had increased recently. That makes it perfectly reasonable why the timing that she sought this OFP made sense and why she was afraid. The court already raised that.
How do we review that kind of a determination? Again, not concerned with whether acts of domestic abuse occurred in the past, because appellant for purposes of this appeal has conceded that, but how would we glean from the very minimal findings that the district court issued that in fact the district court found that there was good reason for your client to have continued fear?
I would glean from it because he states right in the order that he finds her credible, and then he states that she is fearful. Again, he made those findings based on her credibility, and looking at the entire court record, she does explain why she was fearful. It was because the increase of the cameras and the monitoring. So again, those are crumbs that aren't placed too far apart. And I guess I would agree with Judge Brotwold, I believe it was, who raised it, that I don't think that the district court was required in its findings to consider every argument that was made and that it rejected. I don't think further findings other than that she was credible and she stated she was afraid are necessary.
Do you agree that a 5-month order for protection is unusual?
I do agree with that. I expected this to be a 2-year.
And the fact that it was issued for such a short period of time, doesn't that suggest that the district court was concerned, made different implicit findings that, again, we can't review because they're not spelled out for us?
Honestly, I would agree that 5 months isn't common. I don't think it's so uncommon that it's outside of the realm of discretion. You know, I think it should have been longer. Clearly, Mr. Burns's client thinks that it shouldn't have been there at all. But the judge heard a half day of evidence, decided that was appropriate. I would disagree vehemently that this was created into a miniature divorce trial in the way that there was no divorce pending. Actually, it was Mr. Burns's client who filed for divorce after this OFP was sought. And actually, there have been no discussions about my client staying in the home permanently. Clearly, and it's supported by the record in this case, Mr. Frandrup seeks ownership of the home permanently. You know, that has to be divided in divorce court, and no one has ever suggested otherwise. Mr. Frandrup was upset that as a consequence of his actions, he was removed from the home for a time. But I can tell you that the separation has helped my client feel safer. The OFP
I think, counsel, you're going beyond our record at this point. And I appreciate your point that this was not a divorce mini trial. But let's try to confine the arguments to the record before us.
Okay, I will do so. It's just I can just tell you that it is very difficult to argue even against that, because clearly that's an argument that was asserted. That is how Mr. Frandrup perceives this order for protection hearing. And that's different than how my client perceived it. My client was feeling unsafe. She was feeling increasingly monitored. When such things happened, the past, the history had shown something very violent was about to occur. So she sought an order for protection. The court heard about this, made findings of domestic abuse, found her credible, stated in its findings that she's credible and that she is afraid. Was there a further requirement? I don't think there was, nor do I think it's even helpful. So we reverse this order. Nothing is going to change. They're still going to divide the home in the divorce proceedings. So again, I don't fully see that there's a good remedy to this appeal either way. But I agree with all the challenges that the court made to Mr. Burns during his oral argument. Thompson does not impose a temporal quiet requirement. That argument has already been rejected. Essentially, Mr. Burns's client is asking you to make a different credibility finding than the one it found. And even if one would accept that better findings should have been made, I don't think that warrants a straight reversal. I think that's a remand. And again, there's no judicial use or efficiency in going back to create different findings for an order that's already expired without incident.
All right. It appears that there are no more questions, Ms. Terrace. I don't know if you've come to the end of your argument, if you have additional argument to present.
I guess in closing, I was waiting for more questions. I would just also like to point out that these factors that Mr. Burns's client is asserting, we don't have enough evidence, were considered. So the disposition of the home and whether or not removing Mr. Frandrup from the home was an appropriate remedy. I mean, these are common considerations. Most orders for protection involve a separation. Usually there is ongoing conflict, whether it be about marital assets or custody, if there is no marriage, or custody if there is marriage, regardless. These are normal issues. I mean, if every single order for protection that did not explicitly make findings of and reject every issue about, couples in the process of uncoupling was going to be reversed, I mean, your jobs are about to get much, much busier. I think that, again, the evidence is that the court considered it, skillfully decided that those were not relevant considerations. What was relevant was that domestic abuse occurred and my client was reasonably in fear based on her credibility. So.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Burns, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, we've heard description by petitioner's counsel of her theory of what the judge was thinking, that the cameras had this critical role and the monitoring put her into a vulnerable position. We don't know that. We don't know if that's the reason. We don't know what other possible reason the court could have.
And why is that so critical? If there's a finding that she was credible and that she was fearful of future domestic assault, what difference does it make the basis for her fear?
Thank you.
Be a specific finding on that.
Yeah. Page one of my reply brief answers that question. And so at the bottom of my page one, I talk about the Thompson analysis. And I say, merely this conclusory statement, quote, petitioner is fearful of respondent committing acts of abuse against her in the future. And I go on to say, to reach this conclusion under Thompson, the court is required to examine all of the relevant circumstances. It very well could have been that the cameras were a concern for the court, or it could have been something else that the court felt that there was this need for this 5-month term
But Mr. Burns, if the court had said it's the cameras, Are you claiming that that would be an invalid basis that we'd need to reverse?
No,
so then we're kind of, is it a harmless error then? I mean, even if we found that more findings should have been made by the district court?
I don't believe it's a harmless error. I think that it is a reversible error because we don't know. We're speculating on what reason the court may have had. We've heard petitioner's counsel offer a reason. You've heard me say that a 13-month period of time between the last alleged incident and her applying for the order for protection and admitting that there were no problems during that period of time is problematic. We simply don't have a connection between the allegations of abuse and the imminent nature of the threat. And that's the court's responsibility to provide. Whether I agree with it, whether the other side agrees with it, we need to know what the court was thinking. We simply don't have that so that the meaningful review can't occur. And in that reply brief, at the bottom, I go into a reference of the Wallin case, W-A-L-L-I-N, and I say, which picks up on Thompson and says, it is especially important that the basis for the court's decision be set forth with a high degree of particularity if appellate review is to be meaningful. We're talking about one sentence here at the end of like counsel said, we were there for half a day. And as the court has pointed out, I did challenge a lot of things and there was a lot of back and forth. These parties deserved more than one sentence. The parties need more than one sentence, and this court can't make its analysis without that. So I again ask that the court reverse for a failure to meet that threshold level of findings necessary to support the imminent fear of the safety, and ask that that reversal occur. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments today. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.